Hey everyone, this is Steve Donahue with the Legacy Podcast, helping you build a multi-generational legacy of abundance. Today's episode is going to be the message I preached at the church in which I pastored this last weekend. It's actually on chapter 18 and chapter 19 of John's Gospel, dealing with the trials of Jesus, and it is a very exciting, interesting passage, and so hopefully you'll be able to gain a lot from that. Before we actually take a listen to that, I want to tell you a few things about the upcoming changeover to the LegacyPodcast.com from the LegacyPodcast.net. We're about ready to make that switch over. I've got most of the stuff up and running and should be able to finish that by the rest of this week. But until then, please continue to visit us at the website and make comments to us in the comments section under each of the podcasts, or you can make comments in iTunes regarding the Legacy Podcast, or you can give me feedback directly. And you can do that if you write to feedback at thelegacypodcast.net. Also, I encourage you to tell some friends, visit us at Facebook at Facebook/Legacy Podcast. And hopefully you'll be able to continue to grow the audience and provide that value. You can register as a member, which would be a great thing. If you do that, you can do that at the right-hand top corner of each of the pages on the website. There's a place for you to do that. And if you do that, that will allow you to get into the members-only section, which right now has a couple of items that might be of interest to you. There's a debt snowball database there you can use to help you eliminate debt. There's also a chart in there that I have created to show you how to plant, when to plant, different items to plant, how much you need for each of your family members, and how much square feet you need for that, and it should be a valuable resource. I'm not saying that it is by any means foolproof or perfect, but it is put a lot of time and value into creating it, so hopefully you'll be able to find it as value as well. That's in the members section, so you need to register to get into that. Otherwise, continue to download us and listen to us, and I hope you are enjoying it. With that, that pretty much takes care of the business section. So now let's go ahead and take a listen to this message that I preached earlier. In the Gospel of John, chapter 18, I will be continuing through chapter 19, verse 16. So we've got a lot of text to cover, but it's really not something that can be broken down very easily. And so we are going to look at the trials of Jesus and how they relate to our certain situations today and how much implication there is in our current life. Now, if we go to court today, one of the things that we are absolutely hopeful for is that we get a fair trial. And so there are systems in place in our country to where a fair trial is the object. We have attorneys that defend both the both sides, the defense and the prosecution, and that is designed so that both will be able to receive the fairest trial that they can possibly receive. And yet we read on a regular basis of cases that have been overturned. We read of situations where there is somebody who's been on death row for years, and finally the DNA comes out that they were not the ones who had committed the crime. And so in our system, we see that even though there is a great deal of justice that does take place in our system, it is still faulty. Now I want us to go back 2,000 years to another court case or another series of court cases where there was grave injustice. And that was the trials of Jesus. And we see this beginning in verses, chapter 18, beginning in chapter 18. Beginning in verse 1. And of course the context here is that Jesus has just prayed for all of his all the believers. They had finished up their upper room discourse. They had he had been for the last several hours now communicating with the disciples all that is going to transpire when he is taken from the earth through the crucifixion. And then they proceed out to the Mount of Olives. And on their way it says, when Jesus had spoken these words, verse 1, chapter 18, he went out with his disciples over the brook Kidron, where there was a garden which he and his disciples entered. And so if you can picture now for a moment, Jerusalem is set up on a hill. And to the eastern side of this hill, it goes down into a valley where there is a brook. And that brook is called the Brook Kidron. And the Brook Kidron is a stream that flows intermittently based upon the rains. And so when it's the rainy season, of course, it's flowing strongly. When it's not the rainy season, it's a dry spring. And so they walk down that hill, and then going up the other side is what's called the Mount of Olives. This was the place where Jesus spent a lot of his time, and it says that they would gather there regularly. And so he is going up to the Mount of Olives past the Brook Kidron, and it says that there is a garden there. Now, most likely this was probably an olive orchard. And, of course, in the olive orchard, there may have been some other garden vegetables or some garden plants as well. But that area, Mount of Olives, was known for its olives. And so this was an olive orchard that Jesus was going to spend some time with his disciples. But then we come to a dilemma in chapter or verse 3. It says, then Judas, remember Judas had already departed from them, also knew the place, for Jesus often met there with his disciples. And so apparently there was this agreement that after they were to leave the upper room, they were going to meet at the Mount of Olives. And Judas knew that. And so when he went to go get this detachment of troops that we'll read about, he said, they're going to be at the Mount of Olives, so let's meet them there. And so as Jesus is going there, they see him coming, they meet him at the Mount of Olives. Verse 3, then Judas, having received the detachment of troops and officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, came there with lanterns, torches, and weapons. Now, so that we can get a better understanding of the amount of people involved here, I want to explain a few things. First of all, the detachment of troops here in the Greek was actually a cohort. And the cohort was a group that was led by a kilion, which comes from the Greek word thousand. And so often that this troop, this cohort, was 1,000 people. And on average, it wouldn't be a fully detailed group. It was probably about 600 or so. And then along with that group was the officers and the leaders among the Jews. Now, this was probably more like the Jewish police. It was the police around Jerusalem. So to put it into our terms, if you can imagine, this is the National Guard and the county's sheriff's department all coming together to arrest this person. Well, now, why in the world would they gather so many people to come and arrest one man and a little band of 11 other people? Because they had already heard about all the things he had done, how he had walked on the water and how he turned water into wine, how he had done all these various miracles, raising the dead, how he healed the sick. And they probably thought, look, this guy's got some power, so we've got to come out there with swords and clubs and this whole detachment of troops in order to take this guy. And it goes on in verse 4. Jesus, therefore, knowing all things that would come upon him, went forward and said to them, whom are you seeking? Now, obviously, he's not asking that question because it doesn't know the answer. Right before that, it says, Jesus, who knows all things and knows all that's going to happen, asks them, whom are you seeking? And the reason he's asking that, as we'll see in a moment, he says it twice. And that is so that he can be assured that they are not going to do anything with the disciples. And so they're only coming to get him. And so he says, whom are you seeking? Verse 5, they answered him, Jesus of Nazareth. And Jesus said to them, now I love this part. Jesus said to them, I am. Now in my translation it says, I am he. And the he is in italics, which means that it's supplied by the translators for English grammar reasons. And but literally what he says, when they said, we're seeking Jesus of Nazareth, he says, I am. Now if you remember, we have looked at how the I am statements are a description of the character of God. They are the one who has always existed. He is the pre-existence one. And the one I am means it is from the verb to be. He is self-existent in himself. And so when he says, I am the bread of life, I am the good shepherd, I am the door of the sheep, I am the way, the truth, and the life. When he says, I am here, there's power in that. And we know that because what happens right after that? And Judas, who betrayed him, also stood with them. Verse 6. Now, while he said to them, I am, they drew back and fell to the ground. So just by the very words of him saying, I am, They fall back, defeated. Now, this brings up a very important principle about this, and that is that Jesus voluntarily went to the cross. At that very moment, had he not wanted to go to the cross, or had it not been the will of the Father for him to go to the cross, he could have said, death. And every single one of those people, that 1,000 people or 600 people or whatever it was, died instantly. That's what could have happened. He has that power. He could have done that. But that wasn't the will of the Father. But just by saying, I am, he was demonstrating he had that power. They fall back after they recover. It says verse 7, then he asked them again, whom are you seeking? They said, Jesus of Nazareth. Verse 8, Jesus answered, I have told you, I am. Says it again, just to make sure. Therefore, if you seek me, let these go their way. And he's speaking about his disciples. Basically saying, look, take me, let my disciples go. This is not a business between me and them, it's just between me and you. And so, let my disciples go. And this, of course, is in fulfillment of the scriptures. It says in verse 9, that the saying might be fulfilled, which says, of those whom you have given me, I have lost none. Then Simon Peter, we love Simon Peter, don't we? Having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant. Malchus was his name, we read in the other scriptures. And cut off his right ear, and the servant's name was Malchus. And so, do you picture for a moment, here's Peter, right? Got this 600, 700 man army against him. And he pulls out his dagger. And, you know, the word here is not this big, broad Roman broadsword. It's more like a little short sword, a little dagger thing. He pulls it out and he cuts off the ear of the high priest's servant. Like he's going to take on the entire 600 people by himself. We love the boldness of Peter. And yet we question his thinking. Doesn't he understand that Jesus could have at that very moment when the army fell back at the words of Jesus, didn't he realize Jesus could have taken care of him if he wanted to? But he's still thinking on a physical terms. No, I've got to defend my master with the sword. Well, Jesus doesn't need any defending. And so what does Jesus do? Verse 11, so Jesus said to Peter, put away your sword. Shall I not drink the cup which my Father has given me? And he heals Malchus' ear, we read another passage. Jesus didn't mean to kill these people off. If he wanted to kill them all off, he could have. But no, he didn't come for that purpose. He came to be the Savior, to die for the sins of the world. And so he allows the will of the Father to be done. And he allows himself to be taken and arrested. So verses 1 through 11, we see the arrest. And then verses 12 through 23, we see his first trial before Annas and Caiaphas. Now, just by way of kind of summarizing what's going to take place here, there's all different kinds of trials that take place. There's a trial before Annas, there's a trial before Caiaphas, there's a trial before Herod, there's a trial before Pilate, and they sent back and forth and back and forth, all these different kinds of things, trying to figure out who it is who's going to have authority to kill him. That's the whole purpose. They want him dead, or at least the Jews want him dead, but they can't really kill him because they're under obligation of the Roman law not to kill anybody. And so they have to go back and forth trying to find the appropriate authority to finally get the warrant for his execution. And so verse 12, then the detachment of troops and a captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. Verse 13, and they led him away to Annas first, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. Well, now, why didn't they go to Caiaphas first? Well, this we have to go back a little bit in history, because it says Annas was the father-in-law of Caiaphas. Now, what happened when Annas was the high priest from 6 to 15 A.D.? And in 15 A.D., the Romans decided that he had a little bit too much power, so they removed him from being high priest and put in his place Caiaphas. And so Caiaphas was kind of like the Roman's choice for high priest, whereas Annas was the Jewish choice for high priest. And as you might imagine, Annas had a great deal of authority over the people. If you want to picture it for a moment, if you could imagine somebody maybe in a church setting who had been a deacon for years and years and years and years and years and finally decided that they needed to step down and let somebody else take on some of the responsibilities of a deacon. Well, don't you think the church would still be asking that person for some advice? Of course they would. Well, that's the way it was working here. The Jews were going to Annas first because they said, look, he was the high priest for so many years and we loved him, so let's go ask him what he has to say. And so they go and ask Annas first. In verse 15, we get this interlude, and we'll see this going back and forth, where we have these trials, and then we take a look at Peter. And then we have a couple more trials, and then we look at Peter. And then a couple more trials, and we look at Peter. And so we have this interlude with Peter here in verses 15 through verse 18. And Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. Who do you think that other disciple is? John. That's right. He never mentions himself in his own gospel. He always calls it that other disciple, or that disciple whom Jesus loved, or something like that. And so here it says, and another disciple. Now that disciple, of course that's John, was known to the high priest and went with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest. So John knows some people in power. I don't know whether he was related to them or whether he was born into a good family or, you know, what the situation was. But apparently he had some inroads into the uppity-ups, inroads into the higher-ups and the authorities of the land. And so when he asked to follow Jesus, they said, sure, come on, John. But it says Peter, verse 16, stood at the door outside. So Peter wasn't allowed in. He didn't have the ticket as John did. Then the other disciple, that is John, it says, verse 16, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to her who kept the door and brought Peter in. So John says, oh, no, Peter's got to come in here. So they bring Peter in. Then verse 17, then the servant girl who kept the door said to Peter, you are not also one of the man's disciples, are you? And what does Peter say? No, not me. I'm not. Now, back up just like eight verses. Here's Peter about ready to take on the whole cohort in behalf of Jesus. But now once Jesus is arrested, he can't even admit to being one of his disciples. So verse 17 continues. Verse 18, excuse me. Now the servant of the officers who had made a fire of coals stood there, for it was cold, and they warmed themselves, and Peter stood with them and warmed himself. We'll take up Peter's story here a little bit later in the situation. So now we turn back to the trials of Jesus again in verse 19. The high priest then asked Jesus about his disciples and his doctrine. And Jesus answered him, I spoke openly to the world. I always taught in the synagogues and in the temple where the Jews always meet. And in secret, I have said nothing. In other words, he's saying, look, I've told you all these things. You probably have record of these things being written down by the various scribes listening to me teach. Why are you asking me this? Verse 21, why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard me what I said to them. Indeed, they know what I said. Verse 22, and when he had said these things, one of the officers who stood by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, do you answer the high priest like that? In other words, they thought he was being disrespectful. Verse 23, Jesus answered him, if I have spoken evil, bear witness of my evil. But if well, why do you strike me? You see what Jesus is doing here? He's saying, look, find some kind of evidence of my wrongdoing. Come up with something. Come up with a witness. Come up with something saying that I am in the wrong. You can't find it. Jesus was perfectly and completely holy and righteous without any kind of sin. And so he was willing and able to boldly stand up to the high priest and say, find something wrong with me. Then verse 24, then Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. So Annas wasn't able to convict him. So he says, okay, well, let's send you back to Caiaphas then. See, maybe Caiaphas will be able to do something. We read later, Caiaphas, the one who testified that
one man should die for the people for the sake of causing harmony among the people. So verse 25, then we go back to Peter. Now Simon Peter stood and warmed himself. Therefore they said to him, "You are not also one of his disciples, are you?" And he denied it and said, "I am not." And one of the servants of the high priest, a relative of him who was Peter's ear, cut off. So here we have wait a second. I think I saw, you cut off my cousin's ear. Sure you're there. "Did I not see you in the garden with him?" he says. Verse 27, Peter then denied again, and immediately the rooster crowed. Remember the prophecy? Before the rooster crows, Peter would deny it three times. Well, here we have the fulfillment of it. Just as Jesus had said, so Peter's doing. And then verse 28, we go back to Pilate's court. Now, in the interlude here, we have the trial of Caiaphas. Now, we don't really have in Gospel of John the trial of Caiaphas. That's recorded in some of the other synoptic Gospels. He had this trial with Caiaphas. Caiaphas was not able to come up with any kind of accurate accusation. They tried to bring witnesses, and the witnesses wouldn't agree. And, of course, the Old Testament says that there has to be at least two witnesses to any crime. And so they weren't able to come up with two that agreed on anything. And so they were at a loss again. So what do they do? Well, since it becomes morning, they send him to Pilate. Verse 28, then they led Jesus from Caiaphas to the praetorium. And that was early in the morning, but they themselves did not go into the praetorium, lest they should be defied, but they might eat the Passover. So the praetorium was the headquarters. It was, I guess, analogous to what we would call like the sheriff's station. It was the local police headquarters. And the cohort, the ones who had come to arrest Jesus, under Pilate's command and under the ruler's command, the Roman command, they were ordinarily stationed in Caesarea, which was a little ways to the northwest of Jerusalem. And that was kind of their headquarters. And they would only come to Jerusalem if they knew that there was problems or if there was a feast day. Because when there was a feast day, of course, the Jews from all over would come and gather. And so there was millions. The population of Jerusalem would swell to over millions. And so they figured, well, if that many people are going to come in one place, there's bound to be problems. So the military would come and they would occupy the area and make sure that there was peace and order. And so the whole cohort was there. That's why they happened to be there. But they're stationed here in the Praetorium, which was the local sheriff's headquarters for them. And so Pilate was there, and they bring Pilate. Now, Pilate was the governor of the area, and he was, of course, there as well to make sure that the peace was there. Herod was there. So all these kings and rulers and everybody came to Jerusalem during this time. And it says that they themselves did not go into the praetorium. That is, the Jews did not go into the praetorium. Why didn't they go into the praetorium? Well, the praetorium was filled with Gentiles. And Jews did not associate themselves with Gentiles because Gentiles were unclean, especially when they are about ready to partake in a feast day. And the Passover was near, as we saw Jesus celebrating the Passover with the disciples in the upper room, and Jesus was going to be crucified as the Passover lamb. And so the Passover was near, and they did not want to defy themselves by going to the praetorium. So imagine this hypocrisy now. We have these Jewish leaders who refuse to go into the praetorium to testify against Jesus, who is innocent, and yet they're willing to condemn him to death. That's the irony of the whole situation. And here they are complaining about Jesus when they themselves are not willing even to testify if it would defy them from the Passover. So verse 29, Pilate then went out from them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" So in order for him to have an appropriate trial, he has to find out what it is that they bring against him. Why it is that they are bringing him to accuse. And so they ask him in verse 30, they answered and said to him, "If he's not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him up to you." That's a very specific, concrete accusation, isn't it? An evildoer. Why didn't they say something more specific? They didn't have anything more specific. And so they say, well, he's an evildoer. Do away with him. Well, that's not good enough for Pilate. So verse 31, then Pilate said to them, You take him and judge him according to your law. In other words, look, if that's all the problem he is, if you just don't like him, think he's an evildoer, you take care of him. Why do you bring him to me? That's not an accusation I need to take care of. That's not a Roman court situation. You take care of him on your own law. And we have to understand that in the context of the day, the Romans were given a great deal of freedom over their own jurisdictions of juries and judges and courts and all this kind of thing. And because the Romans didn't quite understand all of their religious laws and all this kind of thing, and so they said, look, you just deal with a lot of that internal stuff yourselves. As long as you keep the peace, we'll kind of stay out of your way. But the one thing we ask is that you don't do any executions. So you can't kill anybody. If it's a capital murder offense, then you've got to bring them to me. And so in this situation, what they're doing is they're saying, look, what's the accusation? Why are you bringing him to me? They said, well, he's an evildoer. They say, he says, oh, don't worry about that. Then just you take care of him yourself. I don't need to worry about it. So what do the Jews say? Verse 31. Therefore, the Jews said to him, it is not lawful for us to put anyone to death. So they're saying, look, he's an evildoer, but his evil doings are deserving of death. And so we can't deal with him according to our law. It's under your jurisdiction. You have to deal with him. Well, now, of course, the bar is raised. Pilate realizes there's something about this man that I need to check into a little bit further. Now, no doubt Pilate had heard about this miracle worker Jesus or something, but he had not really come into contact with him. So verse 32, that the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spoke, signifying by what death he would die. Now, the Jews' means of death was by stoning. We read that in the Old Testament. Stephen was stoned, if you recall, in the New Testament, in Acts chapter 6. And so we see examples of the Jews executing people, but it was through stoning. The Romans executed through the crucifixion. Now, there were prophecy after prophecy, and Jesus indicated over and over again that he was to be lifted up. And that was the means of his death, was that he was to be lifted up. Well, when you are stoned to death, you're not lifted up. You're falling to the ground. The only means of execution where you are lifted up is the crucifixion. And so when he says here in verse 32, this is the indication by which means he would die, he is saying that this is a fulfillment of Scripture. Just as I have said, I will be crucified, I will be lifted up, that will be the means of my death. So it is the Romans are going to be the ones who actually authorize and perform the execution. Verse 33, then Pilate entered the praetorium again, called Jesus and said to him, are you the king of the Jews? So this must have been an accusation that was brought. He apparently had heard something about them being or calling him the king of the Jews. Verse 34, then Jesus answered, are you speaking for yourself about this? Or did others tell you this concerning me? In other words, I think he's trying to do two things. One here, he's trying to evangelize Pilate. He's saying, look, is that your testimony about me? Or are you just repeating what other people have said about me? So that could be one thing. I think the second thing he's trying to do here is he's actually trying to find out whether there was actually some witnesses to the event. And he's trying to clarify to Pilate, saying, look, if you're just listening to hearsay, where are the witnesses? And then verse 35, Pilate answered, am I a Jew? Your own nation and chief priests have delivered you to me. What have you done? In other words, he's like, look, I hear all this stuff. Just tell me. Why are they so upset with you? If you're not a king, if it's not this, if it's not that, they're saying you're an evildoer, they're saying you're worthy of execution. What is it? Why? Tell me. Verse 36, Jesus answered, my kingdom is not of this world. Jesus never really just says right out, does he? He always tries to teach and always tries to inform them of truth when he's answering the question. Sometimes he'll ask the question or answer the question with another question, making them think. And sometimes he'll explain it with a dissertation. And at this point, what he's doing is he's explaining with a dissertation. He's asked if he's the king. So what does he say in verse 16 or 36? My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight. Remember, he told Peter, put away your sword. So that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now my kingdom is not from here. So Jesus does admit that he's a king, right? He says, my kingdom. If he says my kingdom, then it's implying he is a king. So he's answering the question, but he's saying, look, my kingdom's not what you're thinking. I'm not a threat to you, Pilate, at all. I'm not trying to take over your governorship. I'm not trying to take over King Herod's kingdom. In fact, my kingdom's not of this world. And we find in the scriptures that Jesus is king. He's king of the entire world. He's king under all those who will believe in him. He's king who at one day every knee will bow, every tongue will confess. But his kingdom spans the whole world. His kingdom spans every type of people. Remember, Pilate says here, he says, I'm not a Jew. And Jesus is trying to say the point, look, it doesn't matter whether you're a Jew or whether you're a Gentile, or whether you're Greek or whether you're Roman or whether you're Scythian or whether you're Egyptian or Chinese or American. It doesn't matter what generation, what kind of culture you are. He says, I'm the king of all those who will believe. I'm the king of the world. My kingdom is not of this world. So verse 38, Pilate said to him, or I'm sorry, verse 37. Pilate therefore said to him, are you a king then? He doesn't get it. He's still trying to think on the physical. Most people just don't seem to get it when they talk to Jesus because they're always thinking physical. And Jesus is trying to get them to think spiritual. Peter didn't understand his kingdom. Pilate doesn't understand his kingdom. So he says, are you a king then? Jesus answered, you say rightly that I am a king. So finally gets the answer. He says, yes, I am a king. For this cause I was born, and for this cause I have come into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. So he says, yes, I am a king. And if you believed, you would understand that. It's basically what he's saying. Because you know the truth, and the truth would enable you to believe. So Pilate then, of course, he says, great philosopher Pilate, what is truth? Pilate said, what is truth? And when he had said this, he went out again to the Jews and said to them, I find no fault in him at all. See, Pilate would have fit perfectly into our relativistic world that we live in today, where there is no absolute truth. And you talk to young people today, especially growing up in the secular world, you ask them if there are absolute truths, and they'll say, well, no, of course not. It only, truth is relative to the person and the circumstances and what they believe and their background, and they'll go into all this kind of stuff. Well, he would have fit in perfectly with that. Pilate would have, what is truth? Jesus had already explained what truth is. What did he say? I am truth. And the truth will set you free. And so he explains to Pilate that he is truth, and that if he had known truth, then he would have understood who Jesus was. But because he didn't know the truth, he didn't believe in who Jesus is. And so he goes out, and Pilate, of course, still does not have any concrete reason to execute him. And so he goes out to the crowd, and he says, I find no fault in him at all. Well, this is not good enough for the Jews, as you might imagine. They want him dead. And so verse 39, but you have a custom that I should release someone to you at the Passover. Do you therefore want me to release to you the king of the Jews? So apparently there was this custom that Pilate, in order to please the people, as the great politician that he is, wants to give them some kind of benefit, some kind of thing to make them like him. And one of those things is that every year during Passover, he would release to them a prisoner of their own. And so it was time for that. And he's thinking, well, look, I could release Jesus to them, and then I could serve, kill two birds with one stone. I could relieve my conscience knowing that I wouldn't have to convict the non-guilty man. And I would also be able to appease them by giving them the person that they wanted. He says, this is a win-win, man. I'll be able to get elections for the next 10 years by doing this. He's thinking politically at this point. But the Jews won't have it. Verse 40, then they all cried again, saying, not this man, but Barabbas. Now, Barabbas was a robber. Now, the word robber there can actually carry the connotation of being an insurrectionist, meaning that he was probably somebody who had led a guerrilla insurgence against the Roman government. And that's why he was in prison as a murderer. And so, imagine here now, Jesus, who is wanting all people to come under his under his peace and under his rule as the King of Kings. Not by force, but by the love initiated through the cross. And on the other hand, you have Barabbas, who's willing to kill and to murder and to make force other people into subjection and to freedom and these kinds of things that he is trying to do through his insurrection. And what do the Jewish people choose? They choose Barabbas rather than Jesus. So chapter 19, verse 1. So then Pilate took Jesus and scourged him. Now, we have to think about this for a moment, because sometimes the Bible says words assuming that we understand what they're talking about. Because in the first century, when John had penned scourged, everybody would have known what that meant. When we read that word, we think, okay, so he was scourged. And then we read the next verse, and we go on. But we don't really understand the depths of what was taking place here. When someone was scourged, what they would do typically is they would have this rod, and on this rod would be these leather bands. It's called a cat of nine tails. And they would usually have these bands, and at the end of these bands would either be tied some bones or some pieces of metal, so that when they used that as a flail on someone's back, that though it would work as several different whips into the back that would claw on to the skin. So when they dragged it, it would then drag down the skin. That's what was involved when it says he was scourged. Sometimes we think scourged, well, that would just mean he was hit over the head a few times with a bat or something. Well, that would have been bad enough, and he would have done that too. But no, what happened was that his back was ripped apart with this scourging, with this flogging that took place. Now, Pilate has not found any fault in him yet, right? And yet he's willing to scourge this guy? He's willing to flog him? So verse 2. And the soldiers twisted a crown of thorns and put it on his head. And they put on him a purple robe. This is all designed to mock him. And the thorns here were probably thorns from a thorn bush that had probably 8 to 12 inch long thorns on it. So it was not this small little thorn. It was huge thorns that probably worked its way into the brow and into the crown of our Lord as it was twisted and caused him to bleed exceedingly on that. The spikes were from a date palm, and the purple robe was designed to be the color of royalty. And so it was a way of mocking him, and he had said that he was a king, and so they are mocking him as the king. So verse 4, it says, then Pilate said again, or put out again, and they said, behold, I am bringing him out to you, that you may know that I find no fault in him. Verse 3, they said to him, hail, King of the Jews, again mocking. They struck him with their hands. So then Pilate brings him out. And the idea probably that Pilate had was that when he brought him out, he would have been bleeding and bruised and broken nearly to the point of death already. And probably what Pilate was hoping was that they would have some sympathy upon him now, looking upon this state of this one who was supposedly all this dangerous, horrible man, and now he's bleeding and dying in front of them, and he was probably thinking to themselves, well, now they'll not ask for anything more. They'll see him dying and they'll say, that's good enough. So he brings him out and says, behold your man. In verse 5, then Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, and Pilate said to them, behold your man. Verse 6, therefore when the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out saying, crucify him! Crucify him! Pilate said to them, you take him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him. You see the insistence of Pilate here? He's saying, look, I have no reason to crucify him. Sure, I'll flog him and scourge him and put this crowns on him and beat him and do all these kinds of things. You know, in our country, we're considered innocent until proven guilty, right? And there are all kinds of laws on the books saying that when someone is arrested, they're supposed to be treated civilly. And, you know, sometimes we can see police brutality and things like that, and certainly that's contrary to the laws of our land. And those laws are designed so that someone who is innocent is not treated as though guilty before they have a trial. And yet Jesus here, even though Pilate found no fault in him, was treating them as though he was guilty. So they bring out and the crowd cries out, "Crucify him." Verse 7, the Jews answered, "We have a law, and according to our law, he ought to die because he made himself the Son of God." So originally, their accusation was, he's an evildoer, worthy of death. Well, obviously, that didn't convince Pilate very good. So now they change their tactic. And they say, he calls himself the Son of God. Now, this idea of Son of God in the Roman culture was more than what we understand it. Because they had all kinds of deities who had children. And they were called demagogues or semi-gods or some kind of lesser deity. And so when they had this idea of Son of God, it was something that probably brought a great deal of fear to Pilate, thinking that this was somebody who might be able to bring a curse upon me, or somebody who might be able to overthrow my rule or somehow bring something against me that would be unfavorable towards me. And so when they bring this accusation, Pilate's ears prick up again. He says, oh, okay, well, let's investigate this a little bit further. So verse 8, therefore, when Pilate heard that saying, he was even more afraid and went in again to the praetorium and said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" But Jesus gave him no answer. Then Pilate said to him again, "Are you not speaking to me? Do you not know that I have power to crucify you and power to release you?" In other words, he's saying to Jesus, he says, "Look, I'm in authority here. I'm in control. Do you not know that I could make your life horrible or I could give you life? Don't you know I could take your life or I could give you life?" And what does Jesus respond? Jesus answered, "You could have no power at all against me unless it had been given you from above. Therefore, he who delivered me to you has the greater sin." In other words, he says, "Look, Pilate, you're not the one in authority. Hate to burst your bubble. God's the one in authority. You wouldn't be where you are right now. You wouldn't be sitting where you are. You wouldn't be making judgment on me. You wouldn't be doing anything that you do right now if it were not for God's hand in your life. You're placed where you are because God placed you there." And then verse 12, from then on, Pilate sought to release him. He says, "Well, look, I definitely want to be on this guy's side now." But then those great words right there, right after that. But the Jews cried out saying, "If you let this man go, you're not Caesar's friend." So now Pilate has a choice. Am I going to be the friend of Jesus? Or am I going to be the friend of Caesar? So they go on, "Whoever makes himself a king speaks against Caesar." And we have to back up for a moment here and find out how Pilate got his rule and Pilate got his ability to govern there, as many of the governors and rulers of the day do, by manipulation and control and favors and things like that. And so he was ruled. Now, there had been two other incidences prior to this where he was censured by the Roman government. In other words, he was this close to losing his governorship. And so when the crowd threatens to go to Caesar over this, what's Pilate thinking? "I'm about ready to lose my job." And so as a good politician, he says, "Look, whatever I need to do to win election, okay, if I need to say I'm going to lower taxes, I'll lower taxes. If I need to say that I'm going to, eliminate debt, then I'm going to eliminate the debt. If I'm going to say that I'm strong on defense, then I'm strong on defense." He's acting just like a politician. And so when they say, "Look, we're going to Caesar, if you don't do this," he's thinking to himself, "Well, if you tell my boss, I'm losing my job." So he has to make a choice. So verse 13, when Pilate heard that saying, he brought Jesus out and sat him in the judgment seat in the place that is called the pavement, but in Hebrew, Gabbatha. So the judgment seat here, this is the seat that he sat on when he made his official judgments, his official sentences. It would be like sitting behind the judge's desk at the courtroom. And when the judge brings down his gavel and says, verdict, guilty, then that was the final say. And so when he sits in his seat and begins to say what he's about ready to say, it was the final verdict. And so what does he say? Well, verse 14, it says, now it was the preparation day of the Passover. That means it was the day that they prepared so that the Passover they could celebrate. And it was the sixth hour, 12 o'clock. Beginning, behold your king. But they cried out, away with him! Away with him! Crucify him! Now, in order for us to understand the actual chant that was taking place, I'm going to teach you all some Greek. Because this is what they actually said. They cried out to him, Aaron, Aaron, staros anaton. Aaron, Aaron, staros anaton. That was what they were chanting. And you can see how it would be a chant. The way that it was framed, the whole thing. They were crying out, away with him, crucify him. And you could imagine how the one person or two people probably started saying that chant. And then the whole crowd started gathering in and saying, crying out until he's thinking to himself, what am I going to do? The whole mob's against me. So verse 15, last part, it says, the chief priest answered, or no, I'm sorry, he speaks. Pilate says, shall I crucify your king? And then the chief priests answered, we have no king but Caesar. What was the whole purpose of the Jewish nation? The whole purpose of the Jewish nation was to be the one nation under God. It was to be the one nation and didn't need a king. Remember back in the Old Testament when they cried out for a king? And they said, we want to be like all the other nations. We want a king. And God says to him, he says, why do you want a king? You have me. You're the one nation in all the land who has me as your God. Why do you want a king? And they said, no, we want a king like every other nation. And so they get a king. And just as God promises them, the king usurps their money and puts them into servitude and leads them astray and does all these kinds of things just as he promises the king would do. And so throughout the history of Israel, they've been trying to break free from the control of the king and trying to find a godly king, trying to find someone who would rule them rightly. And then Jesus comes along. And he says, I will be your king. I will lead you. I will guide you. Come to me, all you who are heavy laden and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon me and learn from me. The one person who was able to be the king that would be a true and righteous and holy king, what do they say? Crucify him. And the king who has usurped their authority and abuses them and eventually comes in and totally destroys their whole city in Jerusalem in 70 AD, what do they say to him? That's who we want as a king. In verse 16, then he delivered them to be crucified. So they took Jesus and led him away. Pilate finally had enough of the crowd. He said, okay, I'll give you what you want. And he let Jesus be crucified and led him away. So what can we learn from these passages, from these events surrounding his court? And I know I'm going long, but I'll try to cover these here pretty quickly. Well, first of all, God is sovereign over every event and every aspect of the trials. We see that, you know, he was handed over only by the power of God. He could have at the very moment blown them all away, but he didn't. No one could prove that he was guilty of anything. He was totally innocent, and yet, by God's allowance, he was put to the cross. He predicted Peter's denial, and it came to pass. There was no grounds for his condemnation, and yet he was condemned. Pilate was able to do only what God allowed him to do. And so God was sovereign over the whole thing. And so what it teaches us is that God is still sovereign over all the events of life. Kings come and go. Politicians are raised up and taken away. But God is sovereign over it all. There's nothing that you will do today that is a surprise to God. There's nothing that you will do today, tomorrow, or any other time where God says, huh, I didn't know he was going to do that. No. God is sovereign over the whole thing. He's preparing the steps for us to walk in. And then secondly, depraved man can do extraordinary evil. The unjust court hearings. You know, I could go on. There's whole messages you could teach on all the illegal things that took place during these trials. How it was done during night. How there wasn't a consensus. How there wasn't witnesses. All these kinds of things. And yet, they were still done. False accusations, beatings to please the crowd, lying, rejections of the truth, favoring political power over the truth and over facts, crucifying an innocent man. You know, sometimes we hear on the news about some child molester who molested a bunch of children and then killed them all off and then killed himself. And we hear that and we think, how in the world could someone do that? You know what our response should be? Doesn't surprise me. The depths of the depravity of man defies understanding. And it is only by the grace of God that worse things don't occur in this world. The fact that Jesus would be flogged without any kind of proof, the fact that he would be crucified as an innocent man, that just goes to prove the depths of depravity of man. So we should never be surprised by the evil of men. We should be thankful that God has curbed our evil and curbed the evil of his world. And then thirdly, without the presence of God, believers are weak. This, of course, is pictured by Peter. Peter, when he was with Jesus and Jesus by his side, and he says, I am, and the crowd falls down, what does Peter do? Takes out a sword, let's take him on. Why? He had Jesus next to him. But then when Jesus was taken as a prisoner, Peter doesn't even confess him. But then later on in the book of Acts, when the Holy Spirit comes upon Peter, what do we see Peter doing? We see Peter bold in preaching and proclaiming to the same people that put Jesus to death. He says, it's you who put Jesus to death. Well, that's some boldness there. What was the difference? The interim time between when Jesus was by his side and when the Holy Spirit came back, the presence of God, the presence of Jesus was away from him. And so it's only when we are in the presence of God, only when the Holy Spirit is in our lives, only when we are able to be in the presence of the Almighty, are we able to have the boldness that we need to live life. And so it is only...
And with that, this has been the Legacy Podcast, helping you build a multi-generational legacy of abundance. What will you do today to build your legacy?
Believe that the world would still be changed by just one life.